And this is kind of what prompted me to address this issue. Okay, so what I want to do is I just kind of want to recap some of the history with this, as far as my personal history and awareness of this debate about whether or not Codex Sinaiticus is actually old or of more recent origin. So if you would get your Bible and turn to Mark 16. Turn to Mark 16. Now, I did the same thing when I first brought this up. So I brought this up for the first time in the summer of 2017. So it's been 4 years since I first brought it up, and it's been about 3 years since I've talked about it at all. And there's some reasons for that, which I'll explain as we get started. So it's important for you to realize that I'm not working off of a structured set of notes. I'm just working off of some random thoughts and so forth that I have in my mind regarding this particular subject matter. So if you go to Mark 16 and look at verse 9, I'm using a Schofield Reference Bible here. This is one of the church's copies. You can see it's beat up and the kids have probably mangled it a little bit there. But anyway, my Bible is in my bag there, and we're just going to use this one. On verse 9, I have a footnote in this Bible, number 1. And if I go to number 1, it says, the passage from verse 9 to the end is not found in the two most ancient manuscripts, the Sinaitic and the Vatican. And others have it with partial omissions and variations. But it is quoted by Irenaeus and Hippolytus in the 2nd or 3rd century. Okay? So, the idea that this passage from verse 9 all the way to verse 20 should be questioned or of doubtful authenticity as far as its place in the canon of Scripture is really coming from the fact that it is omitted from two unsealed manuscripts, or all manuscripts in all capital letters. The first one is the one that's in the possession of the Vatican, Vaticanus, and the second one is the one that was discovered or unearthed at the Mount St. Catherine's Monastery in Mount Sinai, otherwise known as Sinaiticus, okay? So, two witnesses, text critics and scholars will say that that whole passage has no place in the Word of God, despite the very high amounts of evidence in other places, okay? So, the Codex Sinaiticus was discovered by Tischendorf at St. Catherine's Monastery in 1844. And he took about 63 leaves of it back with him to Germany and presented them to Prince Frederick of Saxony as a gift, and called these 63 leaves Codex Frederico Augustanus in commemoration of the person that sent him there. Tischendorf comes back in 1853 and gets nothing. And then he goes back again in 1859, this time under the auspices of the Russian Tsar, and takes the remaining 315 leaves, ultimately back with him into St. Petersburg, Russia. Okay, so that's review. And I know that all of you have great memory of all of that from 4 or 5 years ago and so on. Okay, but what I first want to talk to you about is my own personal history. So on the church's website, there is a series of studies titled A Tale of Two Constantines, Rethinking Codex Sinaiticus. Okay? And if you go all the way back in starting in June 4, 2017, I started to go over this information. And I started to present this information. And let me just kind of give you a little bit of the backstory here. Okay? So I got a bunch of stuff with me here this morning, and I brought it sort of for visual aids. But in late March of 2017, I saw an advertisement for this book, Neither Oldest Nor Best, by David Sorensen on the internet. Okay, and the subtitle is How the Foundational Manuscripts of Modern Translations Are Unreliable. This is written by David Sorensen. It was published in the spring of 2017. So, you know that here at the Assembly, we've been in the middle of a very long study on the issues of inspiration, preservation, transmission, canonicity, and the translation of the Word of God. And back at that point in 2017, we were talking still about the issues related to preservation. And so I bought this, and it was delivered to my house. Back in those days, it came on a Sunday. Amazon delivered it on a Sunday. The following Monday, Becky went in for her surgery on her neck. And so I bought this hoping it would come so that I could read it at the hospital while I was in the waiting room and so forth. Okay, so it came in time, and I sat down and I read all of this book in 2 days while Becky was recuperating. And I didn't really know what the book was about. I just it looks good, it's hot off the press, I should probably read it, so I went and got it. And what I discovered was that the book was questioning whether or not Codex Sinaiticus was really an ancient 4th century manuscript, okay? And it's suggesting and was arguing that Codex Sinaiticus may have been the creation of a Greek named Constantine Simonides in 1840, and because of some different things that happened, it was passed off in the scholarly world as an ancient document, okay? Now, there's a lot of stuff that's said, so I read that book first, and like I do with all the books that I read, I'm always looking at the footnotes, okay? Someday I should do a study just on how to read a book, okay? Because what I'm doing constantly when I'm reading something is I'm paying attention to what sources this author is using to write his book, and then I'm going to the internet to check and find if I can obtain those sources myself and sort of back check and make sure that what this person is saying is in fact accurate to what the sources that they're quoting, okay? So in reading Sorensen's book, Neither Oldest Nor Best, I became aware of this book, The Forging of Codex Sinaiticus, by Dr. William or Bill Cooper, okay? This book was published in 2016. So this book came out in 2016, Neither Oldest Nor Best came out in 2017, all right? So in reading these two books, I became aware of Codex Sinaiticus and the Simonides Affair by J.K. Eliot. This book was written in 1983. So within 3 weeks of reading the first one, I had these books in my possession and I was reading through them. As things came about, I realized that Chris Pinto of Abdulum Films had done a video called Tares Among the Wheat, and this was done in 2012, okay? And he's kind of the one, in my opinion, that reinvigorated an old discussion about the authenticity of Codex Sinaiticus, okay? And then, from there, Dave Reed and I started talking, etc., and we started looking at some things. And within about 6 months, I had pulled all this information off the internet, this stack of research here, which I still have, and I just took this picture this morning of all the different stuff that we were able to glean from the internet and take advantage of. We also have a shared research folder that has tons and tons and tons of information in it related to this. And if I'll just show you the sort of the level of information that we were able to pull. So my point in showing you all of this is to remind you of what was going on. So this entire Dropbox folder here, this is a shared folder between Dave and I that has just tons of information related to this entire topic of the authenticity of Codex Sinaiticus that we were able to pull off the internet, and it's broke down into a whole bunch of different topics, okay? So in 2017 in June, I taught a six-part study here at the church that I called A Tale of Two Constantines Rethinking Codex Sinaiticus, where I presented to you this information. Okay, so, and then at the July conference in 2017, Pastor Richard Jordan asked me to make a presentation to the conference attendees, so I did that. And then the following year in 2018, Brother Jordan asked me to present to the pastors' conference, and so on April 28th, I presented a two-part study that I called at the time Codex Sinaiticus or Codex Simonides, understanding how the text of the Reformation was undermined. Okay? So that was in April 2018. In January 2018, David Daniels from Chick Publications published his first book, Is the World's Oldest Bible a Fake?, where he has presented his case that Simonides was telling the truth, etc., and that there's reason to doubt that the Codex is a 4th century manuscript, okay? And then so this was January 2018, and then I made a presentation in April 2018 at the Bible Conference in Chicago. And then from there, I sort of, for the rest of 2018, I didn't really do anything with it. It just sort of was out there, and it was sort of a thing that, you know, was on the back burner for me at that point, and it wasn't something that I was actively engaging in, okay? Then, at the end of 2018, Dave Reed came to my house for New Year's. Their family came to our house, and before he came, he sent me four documents. He sent me four documents that he wanted me to look at before I got there. And, you know, so not light reading, four documents he sends to me, and he wants me to review before I got to his house, okay? So I've got three of the four called up here. The first one, which I'm going to show you here some stuff about in a moment, is titled, this is written by a guy named Kevin McGrain. It says, Is David W. Daniels' Codex Sinaiticus Evidence a Fake? Okay? So he's critiquing this book right here. You can see that that's the book cover there that he's critiquing, right? So Dave sent me that, okay? Then he also sent me this article by a guy named Elijah Hickson, New Evidence on the Question of Whether or Not Codex Sinaiticus is a 19th Century Fake. He sent me this other one by Hickson, an unpublished book review, and then he sent me a second document, a review of Forging of Codex Sinaiticus by Dr. William Cooper, and those two were written by Kevin McGrain. So I've got two documents here, two by Kevin McGrain, two by Elijah Hickson, and I believe that there are more or others out there on this subject, okay? Now these articles, these book reviews that are reviewing some of this literature that I have in front of me here, particularly Bill Cooper's book, The Forging of Codex Sinaiticus, and David Daniels' first book on Is the World's Oldest Bible a Fake? These reviews are basically taking aim at some of the arguments that are made in these books right here, okay? Now, let me just say, this book by Bill Cooper from 2016, and I'm just going to say it, I believe that Sorensen in 2017 basically swiped information from Cooper's book and never really gave him full credit for it. All right, I mean, I'm not the only one out there in cyberspace that has observed that phenomenon, okay? Now, when I read these four reviews, there was enough information in those four reviews to cause me for all of 2019, 2020, and the first half of 2021 to completely pump the brakes on this issue. Because there's stuff in these reviews that I found very troubling to the credibility of what I had been reading in this literature that I've just sort of showed you about and that I've covered in other studies. Okay? So what I did in January 2019 is I actually went to the church's YouTube page and to our website, and I temporarily hid all this stuff. I didn't delete it, I just marked it private because I didn't know what to do with it, and I wanted to see if anybody was going to take this information and answer it. Okay? I didn't know what to do with some of it, and so I'm just like, well, I'm just going to pump the brakes on this, I'm going to wait and see what happens with this. And so I temporarily removed this information or hid it from view, just switched it to private and made it not public on the church's website. waiting for further information about it, okay? Well, that came, at least in some part, last month with this book, which is the sequel, and it's Who Faked the World's Oldest Bible? The Evidence Reveals a Much Larger Plot by David W. Daniels, and this came out again in July of 2021, okay? Now, I am not the kind of person, if I've made a mistake, I'm going to admit my mistake, all right? If I think there's reason to question something, I'm going to be upfront, forthright, and candid about that. There was enough information in these four book reviews, these four critical analysis of the information that I had been presenting and talking about, that caused me to say, I need to back off of this for a while until more information comes out, because I wanted to see what some of these authors were going to say about the criticisms that were being leveled against their work by Elijah Hixon and Kevin McGrane. Okay, so I've read this book, and let me just say something else. I want to go, this is the first lesson, this is the transcript of the notes from the first lesson I taught on this back in June of 2017, and I want to remind you of what I said right from the beginning. So a member of the audience asked me the question, the age of it is only a minor portion, whether we consider it. And then my answer, I said, that's a great point, and I meant to say something that I forgot. It doesn't matter to me how old it is, because I already reject it as a witness based upon the principles we established in this class. Based upon the principles of availability and the fact that it isn't in use, or the fact that it wasn't in use, and the idea of a multiplicity of copies, those three principles we established, it doesn't matter to me whether it's a 4th century codex or whether it's a 19th century codex. I reject the readings in it based upon a scriptural evaluation of the codex itself, right? So I said that in the first thing. It doesn't matter to me whether this is a 4th century codex or whether this is a 19th century codex, because an evaluation of the readings found within it tells me that it's not something that I view as part and parcel of God's preservation of His Word. This codex was not even known to exist until the scholarly world at large, until middle of the 1800s. It has no history of ever been copied. It has no history of ever having been used by the body of Christ for anything. So it didn't matter to me whether this was an old codex or a new codex, because I think it does not meet the scriptural standard for preservation. That standard being, number one, attested in a multiplicity of copies. Number two, a text that's available to God's people. No one even knew that this existed. And number three, a text that was used by the believing church. So Codex Sinaiticus, in my estimation, fails on all three of those points. Okay? It is a minority witness. It diverges even from its counterpart, Codex Vaticanus. It has no history of ever having been used, and it has no history. It wasn't even available to the Church, the Body of Christ, to use for at least the first 1800 years of church history. Okay? So I would exclude it as a witness to the authenticity of the New Testament text based upon those criteria. And I said from the beginning that it doesn't matter to me if it's old or if it's new. I did say that if it is new, it would be absolutely catastrophic to the critical text view that it was created in the 19th century. Okay? And I further said, and let me see if I can find where I said it, because I think it's important. Okay. On that same transcript, reading from right here, the question was asked of me, how was it originally dated? Answer, they date it based upon what is called paleography, basically the study of ancient handwriting. So Tischendorf finds it, and he says it's based upon the style of the handwriting and different features that had been used in a 4th century codex. I should add that it has never been tested scientifically. They had a test scheduled where they were going to have the codex tested forensically to try to determine the age of the parchment and the ink, And then I said it real scientifically, and all that sort of business, and the test was canceled. They never went through with the test. The British Museum had it lined up, and then they never go through with the test. What I'm more interested in doing here is dealing with facts. The reason I say that is I think some of these books are far too speculative. They want to see Jesuit conspiracies and all of this sort of thing hiding under every rock, and so what they've done is they've sort of clouded up the facts of the case and made it easy for people like James White to kind of concentrate on the conspiratorial aspect and say, this is crazy, look at this conspiracy theory, blah, blah, blah. They never really deal with the facts of the case. So as I've thought about this, and as Dave Reed and I have discussed it, what we have decided is more important is to focus on the facts and not worry about how you might explain the facts until after we've laid them out. Does this make sense? But otherwise, you get all bogged down in all this stuff that you can't prove. It's better to start with what you can prove and therefore try to figure out how to explain what you can prove than to come up with some sort of theory out of the gate and lose everybody from the outset. So does anybody understand what I'm saying there? I'm saying that much of this stuff... So I said two things as I first started talking about this publicly. Number one, much of this stuff is far too conspiratorial for my tastes. Everything has to go according to a specific plan, and if they interpret all the data based upon the pre-assumption that there's this grand conspiracy on the part of the Jesuits or the part of the Russians or whoever it is that they think is, you know, driving the conspiracy. And the second thing I said is it doesn't matter to me whether it's totally immaterial to me whether this is an old codex or a new codex to my understanding of the preservation of Scripture and where I think God's Word is at today. Okay? So, any questions about that? Okay, so why did I then decide to remove from the internet for a time some of my stuff? So I want to talk about one point today, and we're going to talk about something else next week. So I hope you're not all bored. Okay. So to do this, what I want to do is I want to review something. So I'm going to load, this is the presentation, what I'm about ready to load here is the last presentation I gave in April of 2018 at the Bible Conference in Chicago, okay? And I titled it Codex Sinaiticus or Codex Simonides, Understanding How the Text of the Reformation Was Undermined. So it's important for you to realize that by this point, I was starting to realize that the main point wasn't so much all the minutiae of all of this, but how the text of the Reformation was swapped out for a so-called new and improved text, okay? Now, one of the points I covered in this, and I'm going to scroll to it, this was a two-hour talk, and I broke it down. There are 109 slides in this talk. We are obviously not going to go over all of them, but I want to talk about this issue. The first issue that caused me to think seriously about whether or not I should believe Simonides and whether or not the information that was being presented in these books was related to the coloring issue. Now, Mike, I think you probably are going to remember this, probably more than anybody else, because I still have the folder of images that you printed off from the Codex Sinaiticus website 4 years ago. Do you remember doing that?
Right.
Okay. So here's where I want to start. So this was my talk. So the first issue was, what color is it? So in talking about whether or not this is an old document versus a modern forgery, one of the major points, particularly in David Daniels' work, is related to the color of the parchment. Okay? So you can see here, on this side of the screen, hopefully if you're watching on the internet, you'll be able to see this. This is the leaves that were in Leipzig, Germany, that Tischendorf took in 1844, the first time he went to St. Catherine's Monastery. Okay? Codex Frederico Augustinus, And they are described in various sources as being snow white parchment in terms of their color. Okay. Then you have the 1859 section that was taken to St. Petersburg by Tischendorf, which is considerably, at least on appearance, darker in color. Okay. So part of the thinking that this is a modern forgery is related to what appears to be a coloration difference between these 43 leaves that were originally taken by Tischendorf in 1844 and the remaining 315 leaves that were taken by Tischendorf to St. Petersburg. These appear to have been darkened in color when compared to these. And they appear to have been, and the reasoning is that they were darkened in color to give them the appearance of what?
Age.
Okay, that is the theory. So let's look at a few things. So this is from my presentation from April. So let's look at a couple points here. All right. So to answer this question depends on which portion of the codex a person saw. So this is what I said then. All right. In 1864, a full collation of Codex Sinaiticus with the received text of the New Testament, F. H. Scribner states the following regarding the parchment color. He says, quote, in the preface on page 30. He says, the vellum leaves, now almost yellow in color, are not only the largest, but among the finest and smoothest yet known. So he's saying, after, in 1864, after Tischendorf found the remaining 315 leaves, that they were what color? Yellow. In 1910, the Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics, edited by James Hastings, states, quote, the wonderfully fine snow-white parchment of the Sinaitic manuscript seems to be of antelope skin. So this guy seems to be describing it as what color?
Snow-white.
And this guy seems to be describing it as what?
Yellow.
So there appears to be a color discrepancy. 1913, New Testament Criticism, Its History and Results by J.A. McClermont, concerns or concurs, quote, the latter was rescued from oblivion nearly 50 years ago, having been found in the monastery of St. Catherine's Mount Sinai by the famous critic Tischendorf, and now lies in the library of St. Petersburg. It is written on snow-white vellum, supposed to have been made from the skins of antelopes. Okay? So, we have a discrepancy in the testimony of what color it is. Some are saying it's snow white, some are saying it's what?
Almost yellow.
Almost yellow, okay? So in 1845, so this would be after Tischendorf's first visit in 1844, in 1845, in between Tischendorf's first and second trips to Mount Sinai, Russian Orthodox Bishop Porfiry Uspensky visited St. Catherine's Monastery. In 1856, Uspensky wrote The First Trip to Mount Sinai Monastery, 1845, in which he describes seeing Codex Sinaiticus. In 1845, in his book, Uspensky notes that best Greek manuscripts are stored in the prior's cells, and that there were four of them at the time of his 1845 visit. Quote, the best Greek manuscripts are stored in the prior cells, and there are only four of them. 1815. This number is up from the three reported by William Turner in 1815. He said, quote, to my inquiries after manuscripts in a library, the priest answered that they had only three Bibles, and I took their word the more readily, as Polcock states that they had no rare manuscripts. In 1743, Richard Polcock writes A Description of the East and Some Other Countries, Volume 5, Observations on Egypt. In this volume, Polcock recounts his journey to St. Catherine's Monastery, and there's an entire chapter on Mount Sinai. Regarding manuscripts, Polcock notes, the library where there are few manuscripts, but I saw none that were what?
Rare.
Okay? 1743, Polcock's testimony establishes St. Catherine's as a religious pilgrimage site 100 years before Tischendorf discovers anything. Polcock got a tour of the monastery, looked around the library, and didn't see any manuscripts that are rare. 1845 now. According to his testimony, Uspensky saw a manuscript with the following features. Quote, the first manuscript containing the Old Testament, which was incomplete, and the entire New Testament with the Epistle of St. Barnabas and the Book of Hermas was written on the finest, what color parchment?
White
parchment in four columns of a long and wide sheet. Now, there's only one manuscript in the entire world that is extant that we know exists that would meet this description, and it's Codex what? Sinaiticus. A four column with the Old Testament, the entire New Testament, and part of Barnabas and Hermas. That's an exact description of what's in Codex Sinaiticus. Uspensky saw it in 1845, and in his description, he said it was what?
White.
Okay? So there's only one extant manuscript in the entire world that matches the description Codex, and that's Codex Sinaiticus. Uspensky saw it after Tischendorf took the first 43 leaves in 1844, and it was written on the finest white parchment according to Uspensky. So, the pages of the CFA portion, Codex Frederico Augustanus, of the Codex taken to Leipzig, Germany in 1844 are still white to this day and don't match the 1859 portion that was taken to St. Petersburg, Russia. So remember that first image I showed you that showed on the left the whited looking sheets, and then on the right it had, would have been your right probably, but anyway, it had what appeared to be yellow color. And then we've seen the varying reports, right? So varying reports on the color, so I'm on this point right here. Varying reports on the color of the parchment depended on which portion of the codex one saw. The Leipzig portion of 43 leaves were described as snow white, and the St. Petersburg portion of 350 leaves taken in 1859 by Tischendorf were described as yellow in color. An examination of contiguous pages clearly reveals the discrepancy. So this is the collage image that is on the cover of Is the World's Oldest Bible a Fake? Does everybody see that? This image was put together by David Daniels. Now, if you look closely, I don't know how clearly you can see this from where you're sitting, but you'll see you have a row here across the top to here of what appear to be more lightly colored parchment sheets, right? And then you have this row here starting here across the middle that again appear to be a lighter color than the rest of the images in the collage. Does that make sense? Okay. So, Daniels and others have theorized that these white parchment sheets are the 43 pages that Tischendorf originally took in 1844 to Germany. And that the rest of these that are a more yellow color are the 315 leaves that he got in 1859 and took with him to St. Petersburg, Russia. All right? Is everybody with me? Here's from the Codex Sinaiticus website. So, I don't know how clear that's coming through, but this is a contiguous page. This page is from St. Petersburg, this page is from Leipzig, and this page is much lighter in appearance on the images of the Codex, on the Codex Sinaiticus webpage than this one. Is everybody following that? Okay? Same thing here. So this one would be the Leipzig, and this one would have been in St. Petersburg. Now I want to point something out here. Notice this color meter. This is a Kodak color meter strip that is designed by the professional, used by the professional photographers to catalog the color scaling on this image. That's going to be important here in a minute. Okay. Here's another example. And again, you can see what appears to be a discrepancy in color. And here again, same thing with the color strip in the middle. Okay? So, just to cut to the chase, what one of Daniel's major arguments in his book, as evidenced by the cover, is that Tischendorf finds it, it's white. He takes the 43 leaves to Germany, he comes back, he finds the remaining 315 leaves. Somebody darkens it, to give it the appearance of age, and he takes it back to where? St. Petersburg, Russia. Okay? And therefore, this is then used to illustrate that there's been some foul play now with the codex in terms of its coloring, and this is used as a point of evidence to say that the codex was not old, but somebody messed with it. Is everybody with me? So, in the documents that David Reed sent to me, so let me just say it this way. Is there a lot in the argument now hanging on the color?
Yeah.
Is it a major plank in the argument that it's a modern forgery? Okay. So, both Elijah Hickson and Kevin McGrain have taken issue with this. Okay, so I'm not going to read all this to you, and I'll put. So here's a picture of the cover of the book, and what they've taken issue with is the color argument and the fact that all of these images here that are taken for this collage and this cover, these images were taken from the Codex Sinaiticus website. Okay, and what these guys are saying is that if you look at, I know this is a little bit blurry, what they're saying though is that if you look at the coloration and compare it to the reference strips, what you see is that these things are taken under different lighting conditions, and the reason they appear to be different colors is not because they actually are, but because of the conditions under which the photographs were taken and then put and uploaded to the Codex Sinaiticus website, okay? Now, I don't claim to be an expert on this, but you can see that if you compare these coloration strips, they're not exactly the same, okay? So here's a reference strip that has the different colors, okay? Just a quick glance at the above collage details show that there is a splash of magenta present in the 6 British Library images that is absent from the Leipzig images. So they are not, what Kevin McGrain is saying here in this article is that this is not a true apples to apples comparison here, because there are coloration differences between the photographs that were taken in Germany and the photographs that were taken in Britain of the 315 leaves, right? In the meantime, have the writers of a lot of this literature now come along and now erected an argument for the modern forgery of the document based upon these pictures, okay? So here we can see Daniels does some vlogs, and one of the points that McGrain is making here is that in many of these images of him holding up copies from the two different locations, his hand is covering the color strips that would show that they're not exactly what? The same. Now, I don't think McGrain's saying that Daniels did that on purpose, but the fact is his hand is covering the parts of the color strips that would allow an observer to be able to see the differences. And here you can see it again here. So this page is from Leipzig, Germany. This page is currently in the possession of the British Library. And you can see that on this page, because of the way he's holding it, is he covering the colored reference strips that would tell you that there might be some different conditions under which the pictures were taken at each location, okay? So here he gives some examples. Below is a page of the Codex in the British Library. So this is the actual page in the British Library, not from the website, okay? Not off the Codex Sinaiticus Project website, showing the superb quality of the original British Library digitations with the color spectrum strip and grayscale included. So that's the reference strip right there, okay? Our color fidelity is excellent compared with the reference Kodak color separation strip, all right? On the grayscale, the full range is represented from black to white. Clearly, when the British Library had these leaves photographed, one of their principal aims was color and contrast fidelity. Now, let's look carefully at the images that Daniels has used on his front cover, which he has taken from the Codex Sinaiticus Project website and then superimposed fake shadows. So that would be these shadowings where?
On the perimeter.
On the perimeter, okay? Firstly, the British Library page left of his collage are representative of the yellow-brown pages and the detail on the collage above. So that would be this side of the image, okay? And secondly, the Leipzig University page that appears to the right of his collage representative of the lighter ones on the top two rows detailed on the collage here below. So here's the one below. You can see that with the color strip, and you compare it to this one, that they're not exactly the same as far as they're in reference to the color strips. Anyone with even the slightest familiarity with color reproduction will perceive that the reproduction of the colors on the reference Kodak strip of Leipzig page is not faithful. The color separation strips and grayscales taken from the above images are shown below, flipped for ease of comparison, and compared to the standard Kodak color separation strip. So this would be the London one, and this would be the Leipzig one. Here's the reference in the middle, and you can see that they're not what? Are there differences in the shading and coloration between the images taken in London and the images taken at Leipzig?
Yes.
Yes. So the reason why they appear different on the website is because they weren't taken using the exact same one.
Right.
Lighting conditions. The center strip is the reference. The top strip shows the color separations in the British Library Codex Sinaiticus page images. We can see immediately that they are indeed close to the reference colors, though they are not quite as good as the original high-quality images. However, we may reasonably infer that the images on the website are reproduced in close to real color. Clearly, when the British Library supplied their digitized images to the Codex Sinaiticus Project website, their aim was to preserve fidelity to the originals in respect to color. The same cannot be said of the images on the Leipzig leaves. The bottom strip shows the color separations from the Leipzig University Codex Sinaiticus Project images. Although the red and canyon are close to the reference, the blue is much too dark, almost black, green is also too dark, but yellow is much too pale, magenta is no longer distinctly magenta, but has a pinky red. Thus it is plain that there is an element of false color in the display of the Leipzig leaves. The colors are false to the extent that the yellow color of the manuscript parchment has been washed out into a shade of light gray, and the brown ink has been darkened. Moreover, the contrast has been increased, as it is evident from the associated gray scale. Okay, now, so, what does all that mean? That means that according to a judgment of the people who actually know about photography, is there a problem with taking an image like this and then using it to say that part of the codex was darkened? So what McGrane is actually saying is when they talk about white vellum, they're not talking about when these people that we read about earlier are talking about white vellum, they're not talking about necessarily the color of the vellum, but the type of vellum that was used. Okay? Let me show you a few more things. So, there's a lot of stuff here. I'll have this link, but I want to go to some of these images here at the end, okay? So here, he's got a breakdown of the analysis between the different parts and showing you the discrepancies in the color based upon the colorations to prove that the different places that hold parts of this manuscript were not necessarily all taking the pictures using the exact same standards or settings when it came to light and color. And then, again, this is all technical stuff. There's a lot of details here about a color analysis, etc. Here's two of the pages side by side. Again, you can see that the different, this one's more washed out in white. This one was from the Leipzig pages. and the color strip is not the same as the one taken here, right? Indicating that the lighting and the conditions under which the pictures were taken were not what?
Same.
Were not the same, right? There's a bunch more examples of this. What do they really look like? The image below shows the full, the first full opening in the Codex Frederico Augustanus prior to the leaves being disbound in 2004. The gilded leather binding is the original applied in 1845 and how it was brought to England and exhibited. So here's what it looked like before it was taken apart and photographed. Does it look more white or more yellow?
More yellow.
More yellow. The photograph above shows significant yellowing and staining on the leaves. The shapes of the stains, see for example the bottom corners, match the stains on continuous leaves in the British Library. Below is the same opening after disbinding and cleaning by Leipzig University Library for the images taken by the Codex Sinaiticus website, which again starkly shows just how washed out the pages are. So here's the pages taken before they were disbound to be taken for the website, and here's what the how the images appear on the website.
Well, it says they cleaned them too, don't
they? They cleaned them slightly, but that doesn't mean they... It just means probably they wanted to move, remove any dust or... that kind of dirt or debris. Not that they were like, you know, scouring them, so to speak. They probably would have torn it all up if they would have done that. So, same page, different lighting conditions, different situation reveals a lot different coloration, okay? So,
one question on the cover, it showed like two lines that were whiter. Were they photographed at the same time?
Yes.
Or they were inserted at different...
So those lines of white were all, those two lines of white were the images taken in Germany under those lighting conditions.
So they didn't photograph all the Bible at the same time?
No, because it's all in different spots.
Oh. It's
43 pages or leaves are in Germany, 315 are in not Russia now. Now they're in the British Museum. They were in Russia. Now they're at the British Museum. The British bought it from the Russians in the 1930s and moved it to England. There's a few leaves in St. Catherine's Monastery that they found behind a wall in 1975. And I think maybe the Russians still have a couple pages. So what happened, Bart, is they took the images at the locations. They never brought all of the pages together into one spot and photographed them all at the same time.
That's my question.
Yeah. So you come down here and they've got pictures of the guys, the scientists who are taking the images. So you can see the picture being taken here next to the coloration chart or labels. He goes into a lot of different things about all of this. You can read all this. I'm not going to present all this to you, but this is one that I wanted to. So you can see that these are not in reality any whiter. So this one's a good one for comparison. Okay. Notice the skin tone on this lady handling it versus the manuscript. So his point is, listen, if you're going to make this argument that it's a modern forgery based upon coloration, and you're relying on the images taken on the Codex Sinaiticus website to make this argument, it's not a very good argument because of the scientific analysis of the photographic images taken from both spots. They were not done under the same conditions, okay? And Hickson says the same thing in this article. And I think it's this one right here. Just to highlight a few things he says, there's good reason to believe that the difference in color that Daniel sees in the images is because the photographs do not give a true picture of what the manuscript actually looks like. So he's not going into as much detail as McGrain did here as McGrain did in this image, or particularly, I'm sorry, this document. But he's basically highlighting some of the same things. Comparing the color standards in the Leipzig and British Library images, The colors are lighter and the darks are darker, which is what we just observed, right? One professional manuscript photographer, this is on page 2, I spoke to, who does this for a living, describes Daniel's neglect of the discrepancies of the color standards as like putting a ruler next to something and then ignoring the readings of the ruler.
That's what I think the guy holding the papers knew exactly how he was holding it.
I'm not going to charge him with...
Well, if you're trying to prove the point with a scale and you cover the scale, that's pretty...
So I'm not willing to... I don't know Daniel's is where he's coming from. He could have just been holding them, but I think it's a fair point that his hand is covering the scaling, the color scaling comparisons on one of the images in the vlog that he did.
The reason his hand is covering it on one side is it's on the opposite side of the page.
Right, the color scale is.
Yeah, it looks innocent, but it's right. Damning because of what it's doing.
It may not be intentional,
yeah.
But he's covering
well, you can hold the page
a clear reference that would have made this obvious to the viewer.
Or just
slam
on board, okay. Obviously show the critical difference on scales.
So on page 4, because the color charts are identical, then the colors we will see will be identical, but only if the photography was made identically under identical conditions. And what we see is that is obviously not the case, okay? So, I'm running out of time here, and I want to. I got to the main point. My main points today were to try to summarize what I've gone over with you before. And this issue of the coloration is one of the major issues that caused me to pump the brakes on this whole thing and say I got to pull this back, because I think McGrain and Hickson are bringing up points that I have not seen sufficiently answered, all right? And they're definitely not addressed by Daniels in his second book that came out last month, okay? So what I'm doing is I'm putting my original stuff, and you can see, guys, if you go back to my presentation from Chicago from 2018, was it very heavily reliant on the color difference issue? It was. So I need to acknowledge that was potentially a mistake. And I think that the gentlemen involved in this, they need to acknowledge and deal seriously with the coloration issue. You cannot just say, well, they're professional photographers and they were careful to do it this way and that way. The evidence that is presented in both the piece by Hickson and the piece by McGrain, to me, is very clear that the images are not the same, not because the leaves are materially different from each other, but because of the conditions under which the images were what? Were taken. Okay? Now let me just say, because I know people are going to watch this, I like Brother Daniels, okay? I'm not trying to disparage him. He's helped me on some different things that I've reached out to him about. But for me, I cannot ignore what seems to be pretty clear forensic evidence that the reason why the images appear different is because of the conditions under which the photos were taken. And then to know that a great portion of the argumentation that it was a 19th century forgery is now based upon the coloration differences, to me, is a major problem for that view. Okay? Now, next week, I'm going to talk about this again, and I'm going to talk about some other things that were talked about by McGrain and others for why I backed off of what I was saying previous. Okay? So, and again, if there's a different answer, I would like to know about it, but I haven't seen anything to me that overturns the forensic evidence that we just went through briefly in these two documents. So what I'm going to do, those of you that are watching this or you guys that are here, in the description under this YouTube video, I'm going to post links to both the article by Hickson on this and the McGrain article covering the issue of color, differences in color and how and why I think that's a major problem for the 19th century forgery view. And if I, and just because I am currently skeptical that that view is correct does not mean that I'm therefore accepting Codex Sinaiticus as an authentic witness to the New Testament text, because I am not. There are other problems with it, but we can't confuse those other problems with the forensic evidence that suggests that it wasn't a 19th century forgery, based upon the line of argument of color differences in the parchment. All right, real quick, any questions?
One, I think your original baseline is accurate, that we weren't using it and nobody was relying on that copy. But second, I'm having a hard time understanding how you could have Kodak scales that were so different. Where did that come from? Was that...
You mean materially different in the readings?
Yeah. How did you get a scale that was so darkened? Is that from the manuscripts, or is that from their scale?
Those color strips are reference strips to the color pigmentations that are in the actual images.
Okay, so that's like a scale of So you can compare those
yes.
and see if they're accurate.
Of how that university or that set of photographers set up the conditions under which to take the images versus what happened at Leipzig.
But with that one in the scale in the middle, it looked like they had two different scales going on. Is that accurate, or is that...
No. What that was saying, I think you're talking about this. Let me find it. Just bear with me.
Yeah. I'm just trying to say, if you took his hands away from those two pages and saw the scales, would the scales tell you the difference?
They should. I mean, especially if you are a photography expert and you knew. I mean, I'm not, right?
Yeah, that's
so this is the this is the Kodak reference strip.
So that's the accurate.
This is the accurate Kodak reference strip. Up here, these two lines are the representation of what happened in the London photos.
Okay.
Down here.